Welcome to Better Sex, where you get the information and inspiration to create and enjoy your best possible sex life. Join your host, sex therapist Jessa Zimmerman, as she brings you expert guests, helpful tips, knowledge, and strategies to improve your intimate relationships. And now, your host, Jessa Zimmerman.
Hi, it's Jessa, back for another episode of the Better Sex Podcast. Thanks so much for tuning in and joining me today. I love doing this show. I get really inspired by all the conversations I have. I mean, sometimes, I think I've said this before, I sit in this little recording closet kind of phone booth where I do these interviews, and I totally forget about you who's listening to this later. I just get so interested in the discussions with all these various people. There are so many different things to talk about, so many different people to talk to, and I'm always genuinely curious and interested and inspired by every single person I talk to. I really have fun with this. I hope that comes through. So I'm doing this, I don't know if I should say this, I'm doing this as much for me as I am for you. Although I really do like to help. That is basically why I'm doing the podcast. It's why I do my monthly free Q&As. It's why I'm writing blog posts. It's certainly why I'm a therapist, but that's, you know, I've got a limited number of people I can reach in my office. So I do sincerely want to help. And in that vein, I just want to make available to you, if you're interested, I have a book list, basically, a whole list of books that I love about sex and relationship. And basically, it was at the end of my book that I published, Sex Without Stress. It was one in the resource section, was this huge list of books grouped by category. But I am making that available as a standalone PDF if you would like to get it. So all you have to do is go to sexwithoutstress.com/booklist. That is all one word. And you can get that emailed to you. And then you can see all of my favorite books about sex. My topic today is about Orthodox Judaism and sex. So I reached out to various people who are sex therapists asking who had something interesting to talk about, and Dr. Shai Krug got in touch with me to talk about this topic. So he works full-time at a VA center in the Bronx, but he also has a private practice in New York City where he works with a fair number of people in the Orthodox Jewish community. He's in that community himself, and then he treats patients who are dealing with sexual concerns from that population. So he's a sex therapist. He did training with that. He's done a lot of couples therapy training and then has got this private practice. And so he's here today to talk about how does Judaism view sex? Now, disclaimer, he says this very clearly. Not everybody's the same. There are all kinds of different sects of Judaism and different interpretations and lots of different decisions people make. But an overview about how does Judaism view sex? What are some of the Jewish laws around sex and intimacy? And how do those affect a couple's interactions and especially how they might deal with sexual problems? Fascinating conversation. I realize that this may not apply directly to a lot of you who are listening. Maybe you don't know any Orthodox Jews. Maybe this seems not very relevant, but we do end on I just found it fascinating, and we end on a little, what can the rest of us who are non-Jews take from this that might enrich our own sex lives? And I just think it's lovely. So I hope you enjoy the show. Here you go. The Better Sex Podcast is brought to you by the Sex Without Stress online course. It's a course for couples to escape the cycle of disappointment, avoidance, and pressure in your sex life. So if you're in a pretty good relationship, there's a lot of love and goodwill, but sex is your struggle, this could be for you. You work in the privacy of your own home and at your own pace to create a sex life you can both look forward to. If you want to learn more, go to sexwithoutstress.com/program.
Shai,
Tricia, I thank you so much for being with me today.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Would you start by just telling us, a little bit about you and your work and, maybe sure. Specifically how your religious views influence, how you practice?
Okay, sure. So I'm a clinical psychologist. I work full time at the Bronx VA and in their in a general outpatient department, and I helped them start a sexual health clinic fairly recently. And I also am in private practice on the Upper West Side in Manhattan, where I work treating the general population, but also specifically helping folks within the Orthodox Jewish community addressing issues related to sex and intimacy.
Okay. So I assume there's a personal connection to that work?
Sure. So I am a member of the Orthodox Jewish community. I grew up in the Orthodox community, so I'm very, very aware of the cultural, religious, and Jewish laws that are related to sex and intimacy. So I think it's helpful to kind of have that kind of unique perspective when you're working with people within that community, as there's a lot of nuance, a lot of really pretty specific detail about addressing sex and intimacy within Jewish law.
Yeah, yeah. And I'm so curious to learn more because I almost want to say I've heard rumors about some of the values around sex and Jewish teachings, but I'm really delighted to learn more specifically about what are the beliefs and the teachings and the laws that apply. And then I guess, let's start with that. So how would you sum up, what is the Jewish view about sex and sexuality?
Sure. Well, I'd like to speak first for a moment about what Jewish law is.
Okay.
And kind of how it's applied to the practice of Judaism. So Jewish law, or it's also called in Hebrew halacha, is broadly defined as a corpus of Jewish religious requirements. So basically every aspect of life has laws spanning the entire life cycle from birth to death, which helps guide individuals and communities on how to conduct oneself. And because of that, like any legal system, it requires expertise on the part of the individuals who are practicing it, but also on the part of the individual or groups who are kind of structuring Jewish law. And there's inherent complications in trying to figure out who has the authority to interpret or reinterpret Jewish law. So to ultimately decide communal norms and practices. So because of that, even within a specific sect within Judaism, you are likely to have differing views on how to interpret different law and how to modify Jewish law. There's some sects within Judaism that will kind of adjust Jewish law to adapt to the times. And there's a lot of debate over how to interpret those laws. So while I'll share kind of my perspectives and how I've been taught, there will likely be individuals who disagree with kind of my perspective on this.
Okay.
I'm not speaking on behalf of any specific sect or community or rabbi or religious institution. I'm kind of expressing my opinions and kind of how I've been taught. But even within my sect of Judaism, you will find different people who argue or disagree with what I'm saying.
Okay, so I appreciate that disclaimer because that's I think that's really important. So I guess if we're going to get a general sense, right, and then your specific slice of the of the pie or how you view it. Yeah, I mean, in general, what does Judaism say about sex?
So, in one line, Judaism is a sex positive religion. So, within Judaism, we appreciate physicality, we appreciate the human body. In fact, much of Jewish ritual and ritual law involves things like eating and drinking, which is involves attunement and appreciation of the human experience. But one of the things that Judaism really focuses on is the elevation of the mundane to the holy, or to the spiritual through thoughtfulness, intentionality, and in many cases, restriction. Hmm. So while sex is, again, is seen as a healthy part of relationships and an important part of relationships, there are restrictions that are put in place and many laws that are put in place to help elevate what can be seen as a purely carnal act to kind of use sex and intimacy as a way of increasing your connection and your spirituality with your partner, as well as even using sex and intimacy as a way of connecting to God. And so, in fact, there's sources that describe the conception of a child as actually involving three individuals, right? There's the man, the woman, and God, that God is actually a part of the sexual experience, and that sex is a way of kind of creating that spirituality and that elevation of holiness within a relationship.
Okay. So you're saying that this practice of using restriction to elevate, I mean, that's not just with sex. I'm imagining there's fasting, right, that elevates eating.
Sure.
Right? There are other aspects of life that this restriction is used to elevate it.
Sure. So even food, for example, anytime anybody eats food, we make blessings before.
Yeah.
Whenever we finish eating, we make a blessing to, you know, it's a grace after meals. There's fasting. There's, we wait a period of time between eating meat and milk as a way of kind of creating a barrier between dairy and meat. And
right.
So even the act of saying, oh, I ate something that had meat in it, I have to wait 3 hours is bringing intentionality into the practice of eating food. And like, I'm very aware of what I've eaten and how I've prepared it. And there's many, many restrictions and laws involved in how food is prepared. But kind of to your point, these kinds of laws and restrictions are applied in many areas across the lifespan to kind of create holiness out of what can otherwise be general mundane activities of daily living.
Yeah. And I'm imagining, I mean, as I'm sitting here listening to you, I'm thinking there are other cultures or maybe religions where restriction would be like a negative thing, right? Mm-hmm. Like, we're not going to do this for this period of time because it's dirty or shameful or bad. You know, like that would be one way to take on, let's not do this. But mm-hmm. you're saying this is really the total other side of the spectrum here, which is we're not going to do this because we are cherishing this or honoring this in a certain way.
Exactly. It's a way yeah. of kind of elevating what is an important spiritual act and saying, let's take this kind of to the next level and increasing our use of sex to create some even holier. So yeah. that's absolutely right.
Okay.
But I'll say that, first of all, there are certain interpretations of sex and intimacy that see sex as kind of a necessary evil, so to speak, that it's really important for procreation, but that, you know, you shouldn't have sex too much, or you should kind of see sex almost as a transaction, as like a necessary obligatory part of marriage. But I would say that as a whole, those aren't the mainstream opinions of how Judaism and Orthodox Judaism interprets sex and intimacy. So again, I think as a whole, Judaism has a sex positive perspective on sex and intimacy.
Okay. And now let me ask you a question. And again, this is one of these almost rumors I think I've heard. So excuse my ignorance here, but I've heard that there is an emphasis on women's sexual pleasure that's built into Judaism too. So it's not just sex positive, but there's sort of this explicit value on a woman's experience in sex.
Absolutely. So there's a Jewish law called Onah, which is a man's obligation of sexual fulfillment for his wife. And in fact, the wife in these cases actually has a lot of control over sex and intimacy. So a man is not allowed to demand sex from his wife, but a wife is actually allowed to say that she wants sex from her husband.
Huh.
So there's a good amount of power that women have within the sexual dynamic. But there are, again, specific laws that are outlined about what a husband needs to do to care for his wife. And this applies not just to sex and intimacy, but applies to things like food and shelter and things like that. But that sex is a part of that, that there is an obligation that a man has to meet his wife's sexual needs. And this, again, this law can be interpreted as strictly a physical sexual pleasure, but also about catering to her emotional needs and to kind of catering or tending to the relationship, the intimate relationship in a couple. So there's a lot of emphasis that's placed on making sure that this is not just a passing obligation, but it's about creating pleasure and intimacy within the dynamic of the relationship.
Right, right. That makes sense. Okay, so what are some of the laws that address, you know, couples and marriage and sex? And, you know, I mean, it sounds like there's a lot of them.
Yeah, there's quite a few.
Okay.
One of the main laws surrounds it's called Tarat HaMishpacha in Hebrew, or in English, they're called family purity laws, which have to do with men and women separating while a woman is menstruating. So the laws are very extensive. So, you know, you and I could spend weeks and weeks and weeks talking about this.
Right.
There's whole fields of study that are dedicated, a religious study dedicated just to these laws. But basically, in a nutshell, during the time of a woman's period, and then 7 days after she finishes her period, men and women separate. So the details of those laws are fairly clear, meaning men and women are not supposed to, they can't have sex, they can't have physical contact in a loving way. There are protective barriers that are put into place to help prevent that from potentially happening. So they're called gedarim in Hebrew, which is basically the translation is gates or barriers, protective barriers. And so those are things like men and women not sharing the same bed, men and women or the husband and wife not sharing food from the same plate, not passing things to one another, not feeling each other's weight, like sitting on, let's say, a couch with a shared cushion, where if your partner moves, you can feel that movement, and that may kind of give you the inclination to want to, reach out and, grab your partner's hand, and that could potentially lead to something else. So there's these barriers that are put into place to help prevent any kind of physical or intimate touch. And to be clear, though, the Bible doesn't tell us why exactly we have these laws.
Okay.
So some people have tried to create meaning about these laws. So there's Talmudic sources and rabbinic sources that try to create meaning, and they outline things like that this separating gives you time to focus on the emotional part of a relationship or the verbal communication in a relationship, or that by separating, it allows you to maintain the excitement in sex by saying, if every few weeks you can't have sex with your partner, it makes you excited to have sex with your partner once that time period ends.
Yeah, so potentially like that restriction, right? Again, sort of elevate something or amplify something, potentially.
Exactly. And yeah. So there are some people who've tried to create meaning out of these laws, but it's not really explicitly clear why these laws are put into place exactly.
Okay.
So those are some of the laws surrounding those family purity laws. And they're an important part to a couple's relationship within the framework of Judaism. Now, I'll also say that not everyone abides by all of those laws, right?
Right.
So again, the laws are outlined fairly clearly in the texts that outline Jewish law, but some people, will say, I'll, apply this to my life, this level of laws, like, saying I won't have sex or be in the same bed, but I'll still touch, or I'll still, share food or
close
to each other. So the laws are fairly clear, but there's varying degrees of how people apply those laws in their day-to-day lives. Another common area of sex and intimacy, of the laws related to sex and intimacy within Judaism, are things like premarital sex. So the general consensus within Orthodox Jewish law is that men and women don't have premarital sex. And some people apply that even to a greater extent by not having any physical contact with a member of the opposite sex.
Okay.
Some may even go even further to not even being alone with a member of the opposite sex, because that could potentially result in touching or intimacy or sex or things along those lines. So
yeah,
as you get to more right-wing Orthodox cultures, you tend to see those laws applied fairly strictly. So men and women may not be schooled in the same way, right? You'll have separate schools or separate classes, or there's limited information or education about sex and intimacy until men and women are kind of at the marriage age, and the communities will say, all right, now you can know this, but before then you kind of want to hold some of that information a little bit more carefully. So those are some other laws that are prevalent within the Jewish community. And again, those laws are also not all held as closely as within different sects within Judaism. So
right,
you certainly do find people who identify as Jewish who will have premarital sex or will have, let's say, cohabitation, living with your partner. But I'd say that more classic Orthodox Jewish law, those are generally not acceptable or not generally practiced behaviors.
Yeah.
I would say one other area of Jewish law that is fairly prevalent are laws about masturbation.
Oh, okay.
So there is a biblical prohibition against masturbation, and the original biblical source surrounded the use of masturbation. It's also referred to in Hebrew as shifat zera, or spilling of seed, as a means to prevent pregnancy. So that was the original biblical source for masturbation, was trying to avoid getting someone pregnant, was non-vaginal ejaculation. And that's been expanded upon within Jewish law, which has identified kind of any masturbation or any intentional spilling of seed, even if it's not for the purpose of preventing pregnancy, as not being allowed. So that can be an area that may kind of pop up when we're talking about treatment for sexual dysfunction, because for certain sexual dysfunction, you might talk about masturbation training as being a part of treatment.
Right, so, right.
So, you know, we can talk a little bit about what the Jewish perspective is, or how rabbis have responded to this question of how do you deal with a medical issue such as premature ejaculation or delayed ejaculation, and how can you apply things like masturbation to address those issues? But again, even within this...
I was just going to say, is that ban against masturbation for both men and women?
So it's really surrounding male masturbation.
Okay.
So female masturbation is actually a liberty, you know, even within more concrete rabbinic sources to say women can masturbate. Now, some of those rabbinic sources might say things like a woman shouldn't masturbate too much because, you know, then, you know, maybe you're taking away the emphasis on sex and intimacy from being a couple issue to being an individual issue.
Right.
But masturbation is not seen in the same light for women as it is for men.
Okay. So then I'm putting that together with your statement that men are not supposed to demand sex of their wives. It's the wives who are supposed to invite this in. So if men are not supposed to masturbate and they're also waiting for their wife, I mean, you know, like when I work with couples, I think it's a little bit problematic if another person is your only sexual outlet.
Right.
You know, so how do Orthodox Jewish couples navigate that tension or that discrepancy?
Oh, so a husband can certainly say to his wife that he'd like to have sex.
Okay.
But that's different than saying, like, in a almost like a controlling way, you have to give me sex.
Right? I need this. So, you have to do it. Yeah.
Exactly. So the idea that that like women don't have their rights in a sexual relationship is completely untrue. A woman can absolutely say no to a man saying he wants to have sex.
Right.
But a man can certainly say, you know, I'm feeling horny or I'm feeling aroused or whatever it is. How would you feel about doing that? So,
yeah.
So a woman can more explicitly say that she would like sex, even if the husband is saying, like, you know, I'm not really in the mood so much. But a man cannot say to a woman who's saying, I'm not interested in having sex, you have to have sex with me.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
But you bring up a great point that for some people, there is a challenge of, what do you do when you have a physical, or let's say you have mismatched desire, where a man wants to have sex 3 or 4 times a week, but his wife wants to have sex once or twice a week? You do end up with a situation where men have to navigate that discomfort.
Mm-hmm.
And part of how that's done is, can be a very individualized experience of how men cope with that. But maybe the use of seeing sex and trying to bring in the holiness into a sex act, as opposed to it being, it's simply the release of tension or a way of getting an orgasm and releasing your endorphins. But the other factor is that even though Jewish thought there isn't a lot of room for permissibility surrounding masturbation, there are still men who masturbate, right?
Right,
and
right.
There are still men who may look at pornography, even though pornography is also not something that is sanctioned by Jewish law. So people kind of will apply these laws in ways that will work for them, even though the laws are pretty clear.
Yeah.
And at the end of the day, you know, before anyone is a person of faith, they are a person. And people sometimes make choices for themselves that aren't in alignment with what their values are. And then, you know, people try to find ways of navigating that.
Right, right. Well, I suppose what you're pointing out, which is striking me as sort of lovely, is a man in this hypothetical situation can use that restriction to elevate the mundane again, right? So in that discomfort or in that tension or in that wanting can be a connection. It seems to me even a connection to God.
Sure.
If they look at it that way, you know.
And it doesn't necessarily make it any easier, let's say, for the physical discomfort, but it helps increase that intentionality that I was speaking about earlier, that the process of ejaculation is not just about the release of tension. It's about, am I using orgasm and ejaculation and sex or an intercourse as a way of connecting to my partner and as a way of creating holiness within our relationship? And So again, there's a very positive perspective on this, even if it can be attached to maybe a feeling of discomfort of having, you know, let's say, a sexual urge that isn't being met at a particular time.
Right. Hey, this is Jess. I'm just taking a quick break, and I want to make sure you know about the guide I wrote about how to talk to your partner about sexual concerns. This comes up a lot in my practice. People have struggles, and it takes them so long to bring it up with their partner. They're afraid that that conversation is going to go badly. Their partner's going to be upset. The partner's going to be defensive, or they just don't know how to talk about sex and sexual problems. Common problem. So I wrote this guide that really helps you address this. It helps you prepare for the conversation, how to introduce the conversation, and then tips about how to actually get through the conversation so that you can change things with your partner as a team. If you are interested in this guide, you can find it at bettersexpodcast.com/guide. Again, bettersexpodcast.com/guide. Happy to send it to you. So how in Orthodox Judaism, how does sex education go? You know, because if you're talking about the men have this, I can't remember if you used the word obligation to please their wife, that's not necessarily an easy thing to do. So, right. So how are men and women brought into the knowledge about sex and what you do and how the level of communication that it would take to learn about sex, but then also to, you know, participate with a partner? Like what's the approach towards sex ed?
So it really depends on which sect within Judaism you're talking about. So within, let's say, the modern Orthodox sect, which, supports things like education and employment and things of that nature, and engagement with the world at large, many of those schools within, by middle school and high school, they're getting pretty structured sexual health education, right? So let's say during fifth and sixth grade, you may be learning about puberty and you're changing bodies and building relationships and communication and things of that nature. And then when you get into ninth and 10th grade, you're talking about, masturbation or pornography or healthy sex practices. And so there isn't really a shying away from talking about sex within many of these communities.
Okay.
And I think there's an openness to acknowledge that long before you're a married individual in a sexual relationship, you're still a sexual being. And so being aware of your sexual development and your urges and your, burgeoning sexuality, it's important to be aware of that and to talk about those things. So I think there's definitely been a shift in recent years as people have been talking about that more and more. I know that certainly in the past, like when I was growing up, this wasn't really a topic that was addressed so openly in my middle school or high school education. So I think there is more explicit education about this in structured environments, like in schools. But there are also things that men and women take as they prepare for wedding, for their marriage, to explore things like sexuality and intimacy. They're called kind of colloquially chatan and kala classes, which just means bride and groom classes, where you learn all the laws about sex and intimacy. So that refers to the family purity laws and the process of a woman preparing to immerse herself in a ritual bath, which kind of demarcates the end of those seven clean days that I was describing earlier. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of laws surrounding that. So you kind of go through all of those laws. Then you also talk about things like how to create intimacy, how to talk about sex and intimacy. There may be talk about things like how to engage in foreplay, right? So that you shouldn't be jumping straight to intercourse, or how to create, how sex doesn't begin in the bedroom, but sexually begins in the time leading up to the bedroom, and how you talk to your partner and things of that nature. Now, again, that will also shift, or that kind of content may shift in the sect of Judaism that you're talking about. So things may be a little bit more, a little more protective, maybe a little bit less explicit in the language or in the content as you get to more right-wing conservative branches within Judaism.
And that this made me want to ask, are there, within the Jewish laws around this, are there sex acts that are prohibited?
Great question. So the short answer to that question, the short answer to that question is it depends on who you ask.
Okay.
Actually, that may be the longer answer to the question. There are certain sex acts that are seen as problematic by more people, and then certain sex acts that are seen as less problematic, and then some sex acts that are seen as not problematic at all.
Okay.
So sex acts that result in non-vaginal ejaculation are seen by some to be problematic all the time, which means that if you're ejaculating outside of the vagina, it's a problem, but not if you're not ejaculating outside of the vagina. So if you're engaging in, let's say, manual stimulation or oral sex, but it doesn't result in ejaculation, there are some rabbis who will say, all right, as long as it's not resulting in ejaculation, it's totally fine.
Okay.
There are other rabbis or other sources that will say, the Hebrew term is bia shelo kedarka, which basically means non-regular sex. There's room for that to be allowed. So that some sources say that specific phrase refers to anal sex, but some have applied that in other ways to include things like oral sex.
Right.
As long as it's happening within the context of marital sex. So the idea of elevating, some sects within Judaism will say the only way to make sex holy is vaginal sex, vaginal intercourse, and any other kind of sex, or certainly sex that involves non-vaginal ejaculation, is, let's say, degrading to the sex act or degrading to the woman. Whereas others will say that as long as it's happening within the context of marital sex, the fact that it's happening within marital sex makes it holy.
Okay.
So
In terms of stimulation for women, though, oral sex, manual stimulation, is that all considered also fine? If it's a sect that is worried about non-vaginal ejaculation, how are they viewing oral sex for women?
So there are many opinions about this. Right. So some opinions say that oral sex is permissible, but that a man shouldn't look at his wife's vagina during oral sex. Some say that it's okay as long as the lights are off. Manual stimulation is seen as being okay. The use of sex toys is seen as being appropriate according to many sources. So the woman experiencing pleasure is actually really, really important to the degree that many rabbis will actually bend some of the laws of what they say is permissible. If a woman says, this is what I really like, or this is what makes me feel good, many rabbis will say, all right, we will create circumstances under which this is permissible for you because your wife is saying this is really important.
Okay.
So even rabbis who might say oral sex is not the ideal way, the woman says, that's actually what gives me the best sensation. Many of those rabbis will say, all right, if that's what works best for you, then you can do that.
Okay. That's it. Yeah. That makes sense to me. Just knowing how, what a minority of women would orgasm through penetrative sex, through intercourse, right? That's like, we need some other tools than that, it seems. So, okay. Right.
So there's definitely flexibility there.
Yeah. And maybe this is an obvious question, I want to ask this too. Does Orthodox Jewish law prohibit same-sex sex?
So the classic biblical and rabbinic sources talk about homosexual sex not being allowed, or male homosexual sex not being allowed. But even within the domain of male homosexual sex, certain sex acts are seen in different lights. So anal sex is seen differently than oral sex, or seen differently than manual stimulation. So even if there's like a blanket statement of homosexual sexual encounters are not allowed, certain sexual encounters are seen in different lights. So, a rabbi might counsel a male who comes who identifies as being gay and says, I'm gay and I want to act on my drives and I want to be with someone. Let's say I have a male partner who I want to be with. A rabbi might say, if you're going to engage in homosexual sexual activity, here are things that are less ideal versus more ideal, right? So there may be parameters for the kind of guidance a rabbi might give to say, it's more important that you continue practicing Judaism the way you'd like to, and if this is going to be a part of your life, let's try to do this in a way that's most ideal.
Yeah.
Now,
all right.
Some rabbis might not give, right. So some rabbis might not give that response at all by saying that any kind of affirmative response to someone saying they want to engage in homosexual activity might be an endorsement of homosexual activity. So they might just say, none of it's allowed. And if you're going to do it, just, you know, don't tell anybody about it. but again, that will vary a lot depending on the sect within Judaism that you're in. So yeah. Some of the more liberal branches of Judaism will be a little bit, will be more open about many of those things. But I think as a whole, mainstream Orthodoxy now really acknowledges that people are who they are and people don't really get to choose who they're attracted to.
Okay.
And people, you know, aren't being turned away or banned from membership in their synagogues on the basis of their sexual orientation. So there's like an acknowledgement that even if this is a part of your life and something and a behavior that you are engaging in, it doesn't take away from the fact that you're first and foremost a human being and you're also a member of our community and your children are a member of our community. And we want to embrace the person, not look at the act and say, we are now discarding the person. Like that's not really I think how most mainstream Orthodox communities, interact now.
Okay. Well, that's good to hear. So let's shift over just a sec to people that are struggling with sex somehow. They've got a sexual dysfunction or there's some concern going on for them. First of all, it sounds like a lot of people would approach their rabbi that's, you know, there's a lot of input and advice they're getting immediately from their church leader, right?
So again, within certain sects, you're absolutely that the rabbi might be the first person you go to. So in situations of unconsummated marriages or women who are experiencing painful sex or vaginismus or men who are having erectile dysfunction might say, this is an issue that I'm dealing with and maybe not have the resources or the knowledge about where to go. They might go to their rabbis first. Mm-hmm. I think you probably see that a little bit less in, you know, more of the modern Orthodox communities or more of the left-wing religious communities, where there's maybe more engagement with your medical professionals or more openness about sex and intimacy as a whole. But sex is, again, in the more right-wing communities is a very closely guarded, protected kind of area as a way of, you know, maintaining the sanctity of sex. You know, we don't talk about this and, you know, this is not appropriate for us to discuss. So people may not really know who do you talk to about these kinds of issues. So the rabbi may be someone they go to first.
Okay. And then in terms of adapting some of the advice that they might receive from a sex therapist or a physician, you know, what people that are Jewish or especially Orthodox Jews, how might they proceed through some of these treatment protocols?
So the application of the treatment of many sexual dysfunctions, according to many rabbis, can actually modify some of the or shift the application of some of these laws. So, for example, a man who's experiencing, let's say, premature ejaculation, and a mental health professional or a medical professional is advising masturbation training to be a necessary part of the treatment for that. There are rabbis who will say that if it's a part of your medical impacting your ability, let's say someone who has premature ejaculation to the degree that they're ejaculating prior to entering the vagina, I mean, that will obviously get in the way of being able to have children.
Right.
So a rabbi will say, you know, that's a problem, right? You need to be able to address that in order to have healthy sexual relationship and to be able to have children. But it also goes beyond the functional of being able to, let's say, procreate, but into the amount of distress you're experiencing because of a sexual dysfunction. So if a person is saying, you know, I'm not lasting long enough or I'm lasting too long and it's causing pain to my partner, and that's causing you a lot of either interpersonal distress or individual distress, rabbis will say, this is now a medical, you're allowed to apply whatever the medical professional is saying as a means of treatment. And then once treatment is completed, you then kind of go back to what those restrictions were in the first place.
Okay. So people who are listening, where this applies, there's often going to be some sort of, I don't know if I quite call it a compromise, but an exception or a bending of meeting each situation individually where they're at, right? And trying to figure out a way to proceed.
Sure. Now, again, you may find certain rabbis who don't agree with what I'm saying. And so there may be some variability in how that's interpreted.
Right.
But I've had, you know, many patients who identify as modern Orthodox or or more right-wing to modern Orthodox, to some of the ultra-Orthodox communities, who I had a chance to actually speak with some of their community rabbis, who they would kind of go to the rabbi and say, here's what my doctor is telling me to do. I don't know, you know, what the kind of the permissiveness of maybe shifting or bending some of those rules. And so I'll talk to some of those rabbis, and I've gotten feedback saying, if this is what is medically prescribed and this is going to be helpful to kind of issue, you go through with your treatment plan, and then we'll kind of re-explore once you get past that.
Right. Okay. So you're doing some of that advocacy for your clients sometimes.
So I, in most cases, will try to advocate for or support them in having those conversations themselves. But in some cases, they may not have the background or the understanding of, let's say, physiology or anatomy to be able to explain, here's why this is an important part to treatment. So
right.
I have had some of those conversations. Obviously, everything is done with consent. You know, I'm never
right.
speaking with anybody without consent from a patient.
Right.
In some cases, it's helpful to be able to kind of help inform a couple's rabbi about how some of the treatment practices can impact their course of treatment.
And would that be, you know, as a non-Jewish therapist myself, if I had an Orthodox couple as clients, would it be as welcome with consent and everything for me to interact with a rabbi and ask about those things? Or, I mean, because you're in a different position as part of that community.
Mm-hmm. No, I don't think there's anything inherently wrong with that at all. I think going in with openness and curiosity and trying to understand kind of how some of those laws are applied can be really helpful for the couple in terms of how you approach,
yeah,
you know, their intimacy within the framework of Jewish law. And I think it really has a lot to do with the comfort of the couple, but also the comfort of the rabbi being able to with some of those laws. There's so many, there's literally books and books and books that are written about all these laws. So it can be a lot to explain.
Right.
But I think being able to say, here's what you're recommending, and you know, depending obviously what the couple's comfort is, having that, you know, facilitating that dialogue, it could be helpful.
Right. Okay. Did we miss anything that you wanna cover?
No, I mean, I think we covered a lot of stuff today.
We did. we did. I mean, you know. Here's a question for you. I'll just throw you a little bit of a curveball, but what would you as an Orthodox Jew say to me, a non-Jewish person, about what your belief system and laws and attitude, you know, how could that help people that are not Jewish? Like what would you offer to me or to anybody else that we could take from this conversation that we could apply
to
non-Jews, you know?
I definitely appreciate the question. I think the biggest takeaway I think would be the role of intentionality, and I think the role of mindfulness within sex. And I have spoken with many people, not within the framework of Judaism at all, about the role of mindfulness with your partner. If you're talking about non-demand touch or like sensual massage that or sensate focused therapy, that the goal of learning how to really be in touch with the experience with your partner, learning how to touch, learning how to be touched, learning how to experience pleasure in that in touch is a way of bringing intentionality to sex, right? It's not about, you know, the man's penis, the woman's vagina, or in the case of let's say gay sex, the man's penis or the other man's anus, or in lesbian sex or whatever it is.
Yeah.
The goal is really, how do you connect with what matters to you in your intimate lives? And I think the more intentionality you bring into that, the more mindfulness you bring into that, the more sex becomes enjoyable. I think that's a really particularly relevant issue because as men and women age, your sex life changes, right? Sex drive changes, testosterone changes, estrogen changes. And the more you can increase the value and enjoyment with the process of being with your partner and not focusing on ejaculation, not focusing on orgasm, but focusing on mutual pleasure and mutual presence, I think that intentionality, I think, really brings value into a couple's sex life.
Yeah. Thank you for that. That's lovely. You want to just say a word about where people can find out a little bit more about you or get in touch if they want to?
Sure. So I have a website. I'm at drshykrug.com, drshykrug.com. And I have a little bit of information there about sex therapy, and I do couples therapy. I'm certified in acceptance and commitment therapy, and I have training from the Gottman Institute, in addition to my sex therapy training, which I did at the Buehler Institute based out of California. So I kind of try to kind of approach couples holistically, looking at both physical intimacy and emotional intimacy, the role of creating acceptance within a couple and identifying the parts or the values within your relationship that matter most to you and how you connect to those values. But, you know, I'm always happy to, you know, to connect with people and, you know, share information. And if people have any questions, I'm more than happy to address any of that.
Great. I will definitely put a link to your website in the show notes too, so people can visit if they like.
Sure. Thanks so much.
Yeah. Thank you so much for your time.
You've been listening to Better Sex. Please visit our website, bettersexpodcast.com, for show notes and additional episodes.
And that's a wrap for today. I really hope you enjoyed the episode. If you are enjoying the podcast, if some of this material resonates with you and you would like to make a difference and make sure that this keeps coming out in the world once a week, ongoing, there are a couple things you could do to show your appreciation. The first would be to go to iTunes and rate and review the show. That really helps us be found by new listeners when you review the show on iTunes. You can find a link at bettersexpodcast.com/iTunes. The other thing I want to invite you to consider is becoming a Patreon. For a small monthly pledge, you get some benefits. So for $2 a month, you get advance access to every single episode. For $5 a month, you get a chapter of my upcoming new book. And for $10 a month, I host quarterly get-to-know-you and question-and-answer chats over the web, and you get invited to that. I would love to have your membership in that become part of the Better Sex family. You can find a link at bettersexpodcast.com/Patreon, which is P-A-T-R-E-O-N. Again, thanks for listening. I'm glad you're here. Feel free to comment, ask questions, get in touch. I'd love to hear from listeners. Thanks.